It's the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. When we think of our homeless fellow citizens of our city, of our region, we might wonder about shelter and food for them. But do we think about the proper education for homeless kids? The Homeless Children's Education Fund is marking 20 years of doing just that, enhancing learning experiences to empower children. Joining me in studio are the founder of the Homeless Children's Education Fund, Joe Lagana, and the current executive director, Carlos Carter. Gentlemen, welcome to the Confluence and congratulations on 20 years.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks for having us.
Joe, I'm going to start with you. You spent a career as an advocate for kids, as a teacher, administrator, school superintendent. How did you become an advocate for homeless children, which led to the start of the organization?
Well, back about 25 years ago, the federal government was establishing what the McKinney-Vento Act. And what that meant was that every school district at that time had to identify young people who were attending the public schools who were actually homeless. Mm-hmm. They defined homelessness and said that intermediate units had the responsibility of identifying them. I had no idea in the 42 school districts in our intermediate unit how many young people were in that situation. And at the same time, my mother got ill, mm-hmm. and I was in a situation where I had to retire from that job. But remembering that challenge of those that responsibility coming from the federal government, I continued to explore what that challenge was with Jim Withers of the Operation Safety Net.
Right.
Jim introduced me to the kids who were living on the street, and I went to Mark Cherna with the idea that we had this problem, and that there were kids in shelters who—
Of course, Mark is head of the Allegheny County's—
Department of Human Services.
Services, yes.
Right. And explained to Mark that this challenge was coming to the schools, and he introduced me to the shelters, and I went around and visited the 17 shelters at that time, and we identified several hundred, maybe 500 kids who were affected by that at that moment. Mm-hmm. And if we fast forward to today, we're talking about the identification of close to 4,000 kids in Allegheny County who are identified as homelessness.
When people imagine homelessness, is it difficult for people with privilege to think of homeless children and their needs? Carlos, I'll start with you on that one.
Definitely. I think because when people think of people experiencing homelessness, they think of a white male typically living on the streets because we ask people that, but they don't realize that it's mainly women and children, and I think the average age of the kid is about 8 years old. And the impact that has. There are people that are hiding in silence or suffering in silence, if you will. So I think it's difficult for people to even understand the concept of a kid experiencing homelessness and what that means and the impact of that.
To both of you, how does an unstable, uncertain housing impact a child's ability to learn? Joe?
Yeah, well, first of all, they don't have generally a regular place for them to do homework,
mm-hmm.
and that's one of the services that we provide in the shelters is a learning center for these kids when they find themselves in a shelter that they're able to do homework in one of the learning centers which HCEF is built. So giving them the supports to do their homework with tutors and mentors and those kinds of services are something that didn't exist before HCEF existed. So it's really great to say that most of those shelters now have those services.
Mm-hmm. Carlos.
Right, and I think a lot of young people are really challenged, in addition to the instability, but a lot of trauma that they experience and the shame, and that impacts their ability to focus and learn. A lot of these young people are very capable when you meet their basic needs, and so I think we're trying to do that. And now we're actually working with a lot of teens in the high schools, not just in a shelter, trying to reach doubled up populations, which is essentially people that are not necessarily living on the street, but they're bouncing around from place to place in very unstable situations. So we're trying to support
temporarily
them.
Living with family
exactly,
or friends.
Exactly. So there's no stability, and they're not always healthy situations. You know, people are sexually trafficked. A lot of things are going on, and they're taking advantage of it because people know they're vulnerable, or say they're not on a lease, and landlord says, you got to leave, you're not on a lease, so they're kicked out a lot because the other person or family member doesn't want to be evicted.
Joe, you mentioned a place to do homework. I think you had sort of a firsthand experience, maybe an eye-opening experience, about why the need to a place, a safe place, a supportive place to do homework.
Yeah, it was a cold water in the face experience one night when I walked out of a shelter and actually saw a young person writing on the hood of my car. I thought he was scratching his name or some graffiti. When I got close to him and indicated my displeasure, I asked him what he was doing, and he said he was doing his homework. And that was such a stark reality for me that we had a need to provide these young people who had the desire to do their homework and to become educated. They had to have a place to do that. And that was the birth of our learning centers that we put into the shelters.
And so in the spectrum of need, where does education rank? I mean, shelter is up there. Food is up there. Maybe healthcare. Where does education sort of fit into all this?
I think education is critical, but first you do have to address their immediate needs with food, clothing, and shelter, social, emotional. And then as you're addressing their basic needs, you're able to get on the focus and see the bigger picture, because a lot of times people are in crisis mode. And so, and a lot of these young people have issues with reading, which affects math and everything. And so we want to meet their immediate needs and help them to make healthy connections and feel good about themselves, and then introduce education. For example, we had a young lady, maybe like 6 or 7 years old, who really struggled with reading. She thought she was stupid, but we worked with her. And she said, "Mommy, I can read now," and helped her sound out the vowels. And so, and kids get a sense that education can be the way out for them, but you have to meet their basic needs first and then introduce education at the same time.
Yeah, and just that statement, that declaration to her mother is sort of a sense of empowerment,
yes,
of success.
Yes, she's very proud and excited, and we just see, we can even see the physical differences in the kids. So a lot of times, as Dr. Garner will test, a lot of kids or young people are more withdrawn. Until somebody notices them. Like one young lady in our video at our event tonight said that, "I didn't even know, one even asked me how I felt before."
All right. The event tonight is a celebration of 20 years. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're speaking with Joe Lagana and Carlos Carter about their labor of love, the Homeless Children's Education Fund. We alluded to this gentleman. It started out as a single learning center. You've expanded over the years in locations, programs that you offer. So has homelessness itself spread out, not just, shall we say, an inner city challenge? And what challenges does that, in a sense, pose to the education of these young people? Joe?
Yeah, well, it's fairly easy to deal with the young people who are in the shelters. In the inner city, there are resources, a lot of resources for us to address those needs and connect them to the local schools. But when we get out into the county, there's actually two-thirds more kids in the county, in communities like McKeesport, Clareton, McKees Rocks, Wilkinsburg. When we think about that, there's a higher percentage in those areas than in the inner city, and there are very sparse resources in those communities. So the delivery of service is much more complex in the suburban and rural areas to deal with these issues. The inner city does have resources in the county. Department of Human Services serve those shelters in a very, very good way.
Right. Very briefly, Carlos, transportation is an issue the farther you get out, right?
Absolutely. And just trying to coordinate that. And through McKinney-Vento, schools are required to provide that, but it doesn't always go as smoothly as we like. And it's very costly and inefficient. And so there needs to be some improvement there for sure.
We have just a couple of minutes left. So how do you impart the message that homelessness is not a destiny, that education can make a difference, can empower you, Joe?
Yeah, I think over the 20 years what's happened is there is an acceptance now by people in government in those positions who have a responsibility to recognize that there is a serious problem and it is getting bigger. It's not getting smaller. We're identifying more people. We're getting better at that. And the government is now trying to figure out at the state and the federal level of ways to make the accommodation to serve these people much better. And I'm excited to see that. I just spent some time in Washington and also in Harrisburg. There are bills now that are being crafted by our local legislators to start to address these specific issues in a very aggressive way.
Carlos, Joe here founded the organization, served as executive director, finished his work on the board of directors, now volunteering. What's he meant to the organization, and maybe more importantly, to the thousands of kids?
I'd say he's been a beacon of hope. I think, you know, he's been a trailblazer, and I think he's been a canary in the mine to let people know that these young people exist, that they're valued, that there's hope for them, and that, you know, homelessness isn't an identity, is a temporary condition, and through education and support and love, these young people can change their lives and be contributing members of society and become what not we want them to be, but what they want to be.
Your organization doesn't stop with grade school kids, high school kids. You also offer awards college scholarships, don't you?
Yep, through our HCLA, we gave out 25,000 in scholarships to young people who experience homelessness to help them to be successful, yes. And we're helping to tutor kids in college, in high school, et cetera. Yes.
We're working with the 10 colleges and universities now in the Allegheny County to identify kids who are actually in college who have no place to go over the holidays. So we are developing a collaboration among those 10 colleges and universities in the Pittsburgh Council of Higher Education. We have a study that just came out that really indicates there's about 30% of the kids going to our local colleges have a very difficult time with housing and having enough food to eat.
All right. We have just a couple sentences, if you would. What else as a community should we be doing to support the education of homeless kids? Just a couple sentences.
Well, first of all, I want to mention our website to learn more about us and our work and how you can get involved at www.homelessfund.org, and even to come to our event tonight, call to office. But there are a lot of things you can do. You can reach out to your legislators, be more empathetic. Go ahead, Joe. You jump in there.
Yeah, our phone number is 412-562-0154. It's 412-562-0154. We'll have somebody there every day who can help anybody who's interested to try to connect with our work.
And we will have a link on our website to your website.
Thank you.
Joe Lagana is founder of the Homeless Children's Education Fund. Carlos Carter is the current executive director. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being here. Thanks for your good work.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. The Blue Hots are a lively seven-piece jazz band fronted by a vocal trio. Think a mix between 1960s Mad Men style, classic American standards, and throw some Brazilian pop influence in there for good measure. We'll meet three members of the band and hear about how they found their place in Pittsburgh's jazz scene. And this month marks 40 years since the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island. A Penn State study of people with thyroid cancer who had been near the power plant in the aftermath of the partial meltdown has reignited debate about the accident's lasting health impacts. Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
At the turn of the century, the biggest bands around were all boys. Boy bands like the Backstreet Boys ruled the charts and set records for record sales. In fact, the Backstreet Boys held the record for first week sales, having moved 1.5 million copies of their album Black and Blue, until this day in 2000 when NSYNC released their opus, No Strings Attached. More than 2.5 million people bought No Strings Attached, and that record held for 15 years until late November 2015 when Adele moved over 3 million copies of her album 25. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
In some Pennsylvania communities, glass is no longer being collected curbside with cans and paper for recycling. A statewide environmental group is offering a solution. This is the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Carol Holsapple. Justin Stockdale is the Western Regional Director for Pennsylvania Resources Council, or PRC. They scheduled a series of pop-up glass collection events around Pittsburgh as municipalities in the region are discontinuing glass as part of residential recycling programs. So I think this change took many residents by surprise, but not you. Tell me a little bit about the history of glass recycling and single stream recycling, where you put all kinds of items in one bin.
You know, if I think back to recycling when I first got involved in the recycling industry 25 years ago, we really managed commodities. We had drop-off centers where you put your one color glass in one bin, a different color in another. You put your paper over here. You put your this type of plastic in one bin. That all changed in the 90s and 2000s with a move Really chasing convenience, right? So we wanted more people to recycle, and to do that, we wanted to make it more convenient. Our tool to make it more convenient was throw it all into one bin and somebody else will sort it out. And what we found, even all the way back to the advent of single stream, was that putting glass in that bin was really problematic. It harmed equipment. Glass is a very abrasive material, so it does not perform well on conveyor belts. But more importantly, it contaminated other materials. So you were seeing paper bales leave these sorting facilities with piles of glass embedded into the paper. There's no real mechanical way to get the glass separated from all the other materials, just like there's no real mechanical way to get the other materials separated from the glass. These sorting facilities finally gave up and said it's not possible. In suburban Philadelphia and in Philadelphia proper, what we're seeing is those sorting facilities are saying, we'll continue to take your glass, but we're going to charge you a lot more for the privilege. So the sorting facilities say their old cost for service to sort one ton of material might have been $50 a year ago. Today, it's over $100.
So I've heard that one of the reasons behind not picking up glass curbside anymore is that there's not a big market for glass recycling anymore. So what happens to the glass that's dropped off at these events?
The markets are not the challenge for glass. There are plenty of consuming mills out there. In fact, where we're sitting, we're probably within about a two-hour drive of as many as three large-scale industrial glass mills that consume nothing but waste glass. The challenge is getting it to those mills in a form and a shape into a quality standard that they can actually use it.
What does this trend in recycling say about how we consume materials?
PRC, what we do every day is try to challenge people to think about their waste very specifically and directly and ask themselves the question, do I need this product in the first place? You know, and this goes back to the very reality that recycling is not the right answer. Recycling is a last resort for materials that you otherwise can't avoid. So folks that think that recycling is going to save the planet from climate change, for instance, are fooling themselves. That's not the answer. It's about, you know, do we need all of these materials and do we need to consume all of this stuff? We really want to focus again on the materials, the packages that are the most recoverable, most recyclable. Glass can turn right back into a glass bottle over and over and over and over and over and over again, right? It's a pretty endless loop. And so we don't want people to steer away from glass, right? That wouldn't be the answer. We'll just buy everything in plastic. You know, you have to think about your waste, right? That's what we really want people to do, is to be conscious of the stuff they're consuming so they're then conscious about the stuff they're throwing away.
Justin Stockdale with Pennsylvania Resources Council says at their first glass pop-up event in Pittsburgh's South Hills, over 700 people dropped off 12 tons of glass for recycling. There's more at AlleghenyFront.org. That's the Allegheny Front Environment Update. I'm Kara Holsapple.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A Pittsburgh band called the Blue Hots creates music drawing on some disparate influences, rooted in both an instrumental style that defined hip cocktail parties in the 50s and early 60s, along with a jazz vocal style invented almost 70 years ago by a notable Pittsburgher named Eddie Jefferson. They also keep things feeling contemporary with a strong element of world music. Founder, pianist, and vocalist Ian Kane, percussionist Dan McMillan, and vocalist Rini Monteverdi recently sat down with 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker for a conversation about what is it they do and why they do it.
Loving how it knocks me down. Loving how it knocks me down. I wrote a poem yesterday. Inside on top of a pile with all the rest. Head on the melody today.
I am in WESA's studio with three members of that band. They are the Blue Hots, a Pittsburgh band with a unique sound. Rini Monteverdi, Ian Kane, and Dan McMillan, welcome.
Hi.
Hello.
I'd like to start with you telling me a little bit about the band. We have three of seven people here.
Yep.
Ian Kane, would you give us some more details?
It's me, Dan, as you mentioned, Rini. And then we have another singer, Carrie Evans. We have a bass player, Chris Skelly. We also have Tom Boyce on guitar. And then, of course, there's Fox Smith, who is the drummer.
Luther
Fox Smith. He goes by Fox.
And you have three singers, correct?
Three singers, me, Carrie, and Rini.
Tell me a little bit about why it is you do what you do.
Yeah,
why you make music that is so different from anybody else in Pittsburgh.
This band's kind of like evolved a lot in the past, I would say 10 years ago, I moved from New York. And in New York, I had a band that was sort of similar to it, but it was more of a, like a vaudeville type of band. And I was playing piano, sort of like stride piano, James P. Johnson type arrangements. And so we did that for a while. I had a singer that I was singing with there. And then when I moved here, that's when I discovered Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross. And, you know, that's the singing trio that the whole thing was based around.
And let's go ahead and listen to a little bit of Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross just to illustrate what it is you're talking about as your influence.
I was blue and I was always wearing a frown because my gal had turned me down. Then we met and you could bet I knew from the first you were my love, because that's when the old gray now burst.
So instead of just one singer, I found two singers, so it's the three of us now.
And that sound is so very emblematic of the 1950s. And Lambert, Hendricks, and Ross, of course, took their inspiration from a native Pittsburgher who pretty much invented that style of singing, which, by the way, carries the name Vocalese, a guy named Eddie Jefferson. He came up with the idea of taking an instrumental song and writing lyrics so that there would be a syllable of the lyrics sung for each note played by the soloist. And it really caught on.
I've got the blues and don't know how to lose them. I've got the blues and don't know what to do. I'm thinking about you, baby, let me take you.
Yeah, Carrie is the Eddie Jefferson devotee.
Yes.
So I actually met Renee. I asked her if she wanted to join this band. She said, yeah, but, you know, that sounds really cool. Can I have my friend Carrie join?
Renee Montevardi, since Carrie Evans isn't here, I'll ask you to give us a bit of background on how he came to this style of music.
In the 70s, I want to say, Tony Campbell gave him an album of Eddie Jefferson.
Okay.
Kind of like, you think you can sing? Listen to this guy.
And let me interject that Tony is a well-known local saxophonist who has a national reputation.
Absolutely. And when Carrie then got a hold of the Eddie Jefferson sound and he just loved it, he followed Richie Cole and Eddie Jefferson, who were on the road then together. And in 91, saw Richie Cole in California and asked Richie if he could sit in with them. And Richie said to the audience, now there's a small circle of people that know Eddie Jefferson, a smaller circle of people that try to do Eddie Jefferson, and a circle of one that actually has Eddie Jefferson spirit. And he was talking right there to Carrie Evans, who had just sat in. So when we talk about Eddie Jefferson as the father of this music, you know, it carries a lot of weight in our band.
And let me interject again that Richie Cole is an alto saxophonist, again, with a national reputation, who about 5 years ago moved to Pittsburgh and has been here since. I think he's actually traveling in Europe right now. But he was with Eddie Jefferson for many years, worked with him, and Richie Cole was actually with Eddie Jefferson up to the night that Eddie Jefferson was killed outside of a bar in Detroit. Dan, let me ask you to talk a little bit about the instrumental aspect of the band. You don't sing,
nope.
But you're certainly central to the sound with what you provide. So let me ask you to tell me a little bit about what you bring to the table and what influences you to bring that to the table.
Okay. Well, about 25 years ago, a couple hippies came through my apartment with some drums. They were these little mini congas. And I don't know, something just sparked in me. And so I immediately went out and bought two congas, and I started to wonder, is there more? And I discovered very much, yes, there is more. And after that, for over the years, I've studied a bunch of African diaspora percussion, Brazilian, Afro-Caribbean styles. My interest has always been to take these different styles of percussion and be able to fuse them inside of American music in a way. Over the years, Blue Hots have been really awesome, and Ian has been very open to it, and I kind of think of it as sort of like I'm the salt in the stew.
So, yeah, and Dan kind of brought the whole band to a new level. I wasn't really, we had just a traditional kit drummer, you know, brushes and hi-hat, cymbal, and things like this. And so then I kind of got into writing for kind of what you could call like early 60s exotica kind of sound, sort of. Some people don't really like that word, but
it's not an uncommon word for people aware of music, and
right.
And exotica kind of sounds like this. And this is Les Baxter, who kind of came up with this style in the 1950s, and it carried the name lounge music and sometimes exotica.
Right. So I was getting into that, and I called up Dan, because we had played together in a Latin band prior, and I asked him if he'd be into, you know, joining with this kind of exotic sound, and he was into it, but he's got these skills, like these, on all these different kinds of hand drums and this knowledge that he was just not going to be satisfied playing like backup bongos, you know, like with a twangy guitar. So he's sort of introduced the idea where the percussion should become more central to the music. And I thought, this is great. We'll do this.
And this is what you guys do with it in 2019. It's your song, Alternate Route.
And then Fox, of course, Fox is the drummer. He brought it to an even louder level. So now we got like a meters kind of vibe going along with the Dan's World music, along with the Lambert Hendrickson Ross. So we got a lot of things kind of like balancing and trying to mix together. And vocal, and it's hard also to balance things, because the vocals need they need it kind of quiet for them to come out. Meanwhile, we don't want to restrain the percussion on the other side. So it's kind of like a real balancing act.
And you talked about the fact that you are evolving, have evolved a great bit in recent years. I imagine that's a process that continues.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about the song Knock Me Down.
You knock me down whenever you're around. You turn the black and white to color. You knock me down just like a whisper.
That's the song that most resonated with me. It had the Lambert Hendrickson Ross kind of a vibe to it, but there was something else too. There was a very modern sensibility to it, even though it was clearly rooted in that sound that is, to many people, it's emblematic of jazz singing in the mid to late 50s. But
right.
But what you do has a very modern sensibility to it. Can you explain a little bit how you stay rooted in one era but are very much of the present day?
Well, that song has a lot of different parts to it. It's not just a traditional kind of AABA kind of form that one day I just sat down at the piano and I just started playing, and then playing another section and another section, and I just kind of sewed them all together. Yeah, I think in that sense it was modern because it had a bunch of different sections to it. It wasn't a simple classic songbook form or anything like that.
If you wanted to explain the Blue Hots to somebody, is there an aspect of your sound you think is most emblematic? Would it be Knock Me Down? Would it be Island Bird?
Pretty little island bird, enter to a restless world.
That's a really good question. If you had to talk about this album that we just did, I would probably say those two. I really would. I mean, there's other stuff on there that is kind of like much different, like a lot more modern. And there are other songs on there that are a lot different from what we have been doing. But those two, Knock Me Down, I think, and Island Bird, they kind of are following the trajectory of our bands the most closely, I think.
When somebody is witnessing one of your performances, what's it feel like? When you're watching the audience react to you, what is the vibe you're getting from the audience?
Well, hopefully it's fun, kind of like the way it used to be in, like, you know, when people dance to jazz. Like, it used to be dancing music.
I think, too, one thing that I would add to that, too, is that the lyrics, sometimes if you listen to the lyrics, there are really interesting stories behind them.
I think the audience gives us our energy. We can see their faces because we are performing in very intimate settings.
I want to thank you guys for coming in, explaining a little bit about your music. I know what you do is unique in Pittsburgh, and there just aren't that many people who approach music the way you do and come up with a product like you do. So I thank you very much for being here in Pittsburgh and making
your
music and coming in and
pleasure.
Sharing
with
you.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for having
Thanks
us
so
in.
Much.
And the Blue Hots will be playing this Friday night in East Liberty at a place called Wallace's Whiskey Room, which is in the Hotel Indigo. Richie Cole is back from Europe. He'll be performing with them. For The Confluence, I'm Bob Studebaker.
Loving how it knocks me down.
wrote a poem yesterday, inside and inside, on top of a pile with all the rest. Head on the melody today, as soon as I spy your almond eyes and your chip-toothed smile, I confess. And now I'm walking one foot above the throne, looking out in my brain. Cause it's you, cause you, you know. Baby, it's you. You're the muse of the news by the cloud in the blue sky that stands alone. Baby, it's you. You'll be down, be down, knocks me down like a feather, I don't know why. If everything's going my way, then let's go show a wing on my bird. It's absurd, but it's true.
WYEP celebrates Women's History Month throughout March. Today, find out more about Mary Clayton. Her professional singing career started when she was 14, when she recorded a duet with Bobby Darin in 1962. After that, Mary Clayton accepted offers to sing with Ray Charles, Tom Jones, Carole King, Neil Young, and many more. But it was a 1969 Rolling Stones recording that really brought her to prominence. A year later, Clayton sang her own version of Gimme Shelter on her debut solo album. As her career progressed, she recorded a number of solo albums, but her soulful voice was in high demand from other artists too, like Lynyrd Skynyrd, The Who, Etta James, Coldplay, and Tori Amos. To hear full songs from all of our featured artists for Women's History Month, go to WYEP.org/women.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 3 years ago, a study by the Penn State School of Medicine found that a certain type of thyroid cancer was common to people who had been near the Three Mile Island nuclear power plant in the aftermath of the partial meltdown in 1979. As part of a look at TMI 40 years later, WITF's Brett Schultes examines how the study has restarted the discussion around health effects due to the accident.
We are on the northeast side, I believe, of campus, and we've got Lake Placida here.
Chris Achenbach Kimmel works in the occupational therapy department at Elizabethtown College. On a sunny day, the 54-year-old takes a walk around the lake on campus and a journey back in time to March 28, 1979. Chris was a 14-year-old freshman at Cedar Cliff High School in Camp Hill, Cumberland County.
So I think Cedar Cliff was about 14 miles from TMI.
Across the Susquehanna River, Three Mile Island's Reactor 2 was melting down.
Tonight, the plant looms like a pale ghost, the specter of potential meltdown hanging over this community. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission says the core has been extensively damaged.
Chris stayed with her family in Lemoyne while her dad hunkered down in Steelton at the Saab auto dealership he owned.
So I don't think we left town or did anything unusual except to keep ourselves glued to the television and the radio.
There is no imminent danger. That's the official advice tonight, but many people aren't buying it.
Those days faded to memory until a 2010 doctor's visit revealed she had thyroid cancer.
I think as soon as I got over the initial shock, it's like, oh my gosh, I wonder if these two things are related.
Chris says her doctor was not surprised when she brought up the TMI accident.
She said, oh yeah, we see an increased incidence here in the area. She goes, I see it all the time.
Let's break that down a bit. Pennsylvania has had the highest rate of thyroid cancer in the nation. The biggest hotspots are Pittsburgh and Philadelphia, not the mid-state. But for this part of the state, Chris's story is common. People blame TMI for their cancer, and some doctors say it could have been the case. Yet the nuclear industry's position has been that nobody was harmed, and Nuclear Regulatory Commission spokesman Neil Sheehan agrees.
That's not to say that there weren't any radioactive releases during the accident, but they were at such a low level that they would not be expected to have any sort of ill health effects.
Sheehan points to a University of Pittsburgh study he says shows there were no illnesses as a result of the event. But a recent study is calling that all into question.
The vast majority of patients who come here, Penn State Hershey, with thyroid cancer, attribute their thyroid cancer to Three Mile Island.
That's Dr. David Goldenberg in his office at Penn State Health in Hershey.
Are these people right?
In 2017, Goldenberg released the results of a study he led. He used what was learned from the Chernobyl disaster in Russia to look for specific genetic markers that show up when thyroid cancer is caused by radiation.
We found a shift which absolutely can be attributed to exposure to radiation during the correct time frame for the Three Mile Island accident. And I know it's a frustrating answer, but further studies are needed because the people come out and say, well, it's a small study. They're right. It's a small study.
Goldenberg is quick to point out his work's limitations. Still, the study has put him in the middle of a 40-year-old debate. Did Three Mile Island release more radiation than the government says? Did it harm people?
And I don't really have any agenda one way or another. This was an interesting clinical question based on, you know, I face these patients every day of the week.
He says he's constantly turning people away who want him to study them, even though they don't fit the parameters. That is, people who were near the nuclear plant on that day and developed thyroid cancer, not other illnesses, within a certain window of time.
I say to these patients, I'm sorry, but I don't think that that's it. You know, I mean,
as a scientist, Goldenberg won't go past his data, and that can be frustrating.
The data goes where it goes, and the meaning is not any more than it is.
But while he says a lot of people wrongly attribute their cancer to the Three Mile Island accident, Goldenberg isn't ruling out it may have caused this one wave of thyroid cancer.
People see what they like to see, you know? But, you know, in this case, I think there actually was something there.
At the NRC, spokesman Neil Sheehan says he keeps an open mind, but his organization doesn't think the study proves anything.
We're always open to looking at new research that comes along, anything that might change our conclusions. But at this point, we have not seen that.
Sheehan says there was little radiation exposure, so it couldn't have added to cancer rates. But the NRC's position assumes those original estimates were indeed correct.
So, well, I take what they say, first of all, with a grain of salt. So if
in Elizabethtown, Chris Achenbach-Kimmel recognizes this is complicated stuff. Even now, 40 years later, she says when she was attending a thyroid cancer survivor support group, everyone believed the partial meltdown may have had a role. But she emphasizes she doesn't share the certainty that some of them had.
I'm going to say that probably the best way to characterize my opinion on that is the jury's still out.
Chris survived her cancer, and life goes on. She doesn't expect any apology or payout from the government. She's more worried that we, humans, didn't learn anything from this.
Well, as a Christian, I think that we all have a responsibility to be good stewards of what this earth gives us, what God gave us on this earth.
The irony isn't lost on Chris that nuclear power is seen by many people as one way to fight climate change, since they consider it clean energy. But the government still hasn't built a place for thousands of spent fuel rods that still sit at nuclear sites around the country.
So if we're taking that nuclear energy and what's left is this nuclear waste, what are we doing with that for future generations?
For her, nuclear power is not part of that solution. Chalk it up to her deep down suspicion that maybe, just maybe, it was TMI that caused her cancer after all. In Elizabethtown, I'm Brett Schultes.
And for today, that is the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, when Donald Trump was elected in 2016, thousands of Democrats rallied by volunteering at organizations across the country, including Planned Parenthood. We'll talk to Kim Everett about women's health and how local leaders are addressing a new White House proposal to cut some federal funding for reproductive care. Plus, leaders often point to innovation. How do we make sure innovation is inclusive and benefits all Pittsburghers? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski with assistance from Mick Stinelli, Julia Zenkovic, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.